I next met with Dr. Nancy Lin. To begin, she commented on a specific area of her research interest, management of patients with brain metastases.
So there is still, as of yet, nothing that is approved systemically for the indication of brain mets, but there are a lot of trials that are ongoing, and some of them I think are quite promising. So there is, just to review sort of a little bit of what's going on, there was this very interesting report, as you're aware, last year at ASCO of the French group, which was the LANDSCAPE trial, and this looked at the combination of lapatinib and capecitabine. And in contrast to the way that many brain metastasis trials are done, the investigators actually looked at this as initial therapy. So before whole brain radiation, at the time of initial brain metastasis presentation, and as a result, these are patients who are generally less heavily pretreated than most of the patients that we tend to enroll on brain met trials. And they reported a very high response rate, over 60% in the brain. And in terms of a safety perspective, they did not see very many patients. I think there was one who had some amount of symptomatic progression as part of being on the trial. But otherwise, the rest of the patients, if they had developed progression, were asymptomatic and it was found at the time of their usual restaging. So I think that was a very interesting study. I don't know that I'm ready to use that regimen in place of the standard, which would be radiation therapy for most patients, but I think that there may be some situations where it could be useful. And then there are a number of trials, and just to highlight a couple of the ones that are open nationally because people may have access to them, there is a trial of a blood-brain permeable taxane, which is GRN1005, and it was quite active in the phase one in CNS solid tumor trial. So it is currently in a phase two, both in breast cancer and in non-small cell lung cancer. And again, it's a national trial, so there are multiple study sites across the country. And then there's another study that's being run by my colleague Rachel Friedman, which is looking at the HER2-targeted TKI neratinib, otherwise known as HKI-272. And that study also is being opened nationally within the Translational Breast Cancer Research Consortium. And that's an oral TKI similar to lapatinib. But in the phase two, in the non-CNS setting, the response rates were in the 25% range or so in trastuzumab pretreated patients. And so that's a study that's being taken forward in the brain met population.
You know, the two areas that I think oncologists have seen this strategy of maybe thinking about systemic therapy up front is EGFR TKIs in non-small cell in patients with EGFR mutations, and now maybe the BRAF inhibitors in melanoma. Where are we right now in terms of, you know, maybe thinking to the future? Do you think some of the new anti-HER2 agents like pertuzumab, T-DM1, anything that might get us there in breast cancer?
You know, in terms of the brain, I think we still don't know as far as either T-DM1 or pertuzumab, although anecdotally on the T-DM1 trials, you know, a number of patients have developed CNS disease as their site of progression. So I don't know that T-DM1 is going to be the answer for brain metastases. As far as pertuzumab, I think there's just not much data at this point. Overall, we are at this point in HER2-positive disease, we have the good problem of having many potentially active agents. And so I think that both in brain metastases, but also more globally in HER2-positive disease, I think one of the big questions is how can we develop predictors of which treatments may be effective, the way that EGFR mutations are a predictor in lung cancer. And we don't really have that yet in HER2-positive disease.
What about local therapy of brain mets? You've published on stereotactic radiation. How's your philosophy to approaching your management strategy to approaching patients locally changed over the years?
Yeah. So I think that for the extremes, that is for the person with a single met and for those patients who have very extensive CNS disease, those are really fairly similar in the approach. And I think most of the change has been in those patients who have a limited number of metastases arbitrarily defined as somewhere between 2 and 4. And I think there, you know, there's a growing recognition that there are a number of patients who can survive for several years even after the brain metastasis diagnosis. And as a result, there's an increasing desire, I think, to, and a reasonable one, to see if we can spare people the potential toxicities of whole brain radiation, understanding that if one were to treat with SRS alone, that does lead to an increased risk of CNS progression compared to treating with SRS with whole brain from the beginning. And I think there's much more of a discussion with patients about the risks and benefits of these various approaches than there had been in the past, where I think most of us would have more automatically recommended whole brain across the board.
talking about lapatinib capecitabine, and I see that in the ASCO new trial session, you have a study looking at that combination, the HALT study. What's that looking at?
Yeah, so the HALT study is actually looking at the combination of lapatinib and trastuzumab. And the rationale for the study is the data from Kim Blackwell, the phase 3 trial in the refractory population, where the combination did appear to be better from a PFS and even a little bit of a signal for OS in the refractory HER2-positive setting. So the idea with the HALT study is a somewhat different trial design than the usual trial design. So these are patients who have had a good response on either first or second line HER2-directed therapy. And at the time when the clinician would ordinarily transition those patients to trastuzumab monotherapy, they're randomly assigned to either trastuzumab monotherapy or trastuzumab with lapatinib. And the overall endpoint is PFS. The idea or the rationale is that the dual blockade is actually quite well tolerated. So in contrast to lapatinib capecitabine, the combination of lapatinib trastuzumab has a fairly low rate of grade 3 diarrhea, and it's generally quite well tolerated. And of course, there's no alopecia and other usual chemotherapy side effects. So if we were to show or demonstrate a substantial prolongation in PFS, that would be a period of time when patients would not be requiring cytotoxic intravenous chemotherapy.
I wanted to get your thoughts about management of HER2-positive breast cancer. Kim Blackwell's on the same program with you, and she reviewed the data she presented at ASCO on T-DM1. But I'm curious about another area you've investigated, namely TKIs beyond lapatinib. And you just had a paper in the JCO on an agent we've heard a lot about in lung cancer, afatinib, or BIBW-2992.
Yeah. So there are, as you know, a number of HER2-targeted TKIs. We just published this paper with afatinib in refractory patients, a median of about 3 prior lines of HER2-directed therapy in the metastatic setting. And then there are the data with neratinib, where the reported response rate was 25% in a similar patient population. I think that one of the big questions in development in the HER2-positive space is how to deal with the increasing number of active drugs. And it's a good problem to have, but it is challenging from a drug development standpoint, from a registrational strategy standpoint. And, you know, I think that it also means that when thinking about trials that are conducted in academic centers, we tend to get patients referred at an increasingly refractory state. So when trastuzumab was not available at all in the mid-1990s, lots of patients would be referred in for first-line therapy on trastuzumab trials, and then trastuzumab became commercially available. Now we see third-line patients, and at this point we see eighth-line patients. And I think that does make trial accrual very challenging.
What about toxicities with these new TKIs? Lapatinib is a little bit of a challenge to start with.
Yeah.
Neratinib kind of got a reputation as being very difficult.
Yeah.
What about afatinib?
So afatinib also carries with it the rash, diarrhea side effects. And in the afatinib phase 2 that we published, the rate of grade 3 diarrhea was 25%. So, you know, these drugs do carry toxicities with them, probably related to the EGFR effect. There are some newer and a little further behind in development HER2-targeted TKIs that actually target HER2 and not EGFR, and it is conceivable that they may be better tolerated, although the efficacy data we don't know yet.
Where do you see things heading with both of these TKIs?
I think that's a really good question. I don't have a perfect answer for that. Again, I think the big challenge, because of the toxicity profile, they are oral drugs. They are not associated with alopecia, but the diarrhea, although manageable, is something that is real and is a real side effect and is different than we would see with, for example, T-DM1 or pertuzumab. So I think that it's going to be very hard to bring these. I think although one can certainly imagine a registration strategy in the refractory setting, I think thinking about how they might be brought further ahead is pretty challenging.
So one more question about HER2-positive disease. Your colleague Hal Burstein and a number of co-authors just published an editorial in the JCO about adjuvant treatment, and you and Hal had previously also had another editorial that talked about this question and the use of anthracyclines. I mean, sometimes you think we've kind of gone beyond that with all this new stuff, but it's still a very important clinical question. Can you summarize kind of what the discussions have been about this issue and where are you and where your institution is in that regard?
Yeah, so I think that the bottom line summary is that the BCIRG trial, which did include a non-anthracycline-containing arm with a TCH regimen, showed, of course, that TCH was better than chemotherapy without trastuzumab, but was not powered or designed to directly compare the ACTH arm and the TCH arm. And numerically, there is a 3% absolute difference in disease-free survival at 5 years median follow-up. There's not a statistical comparison of that because the study was not designed or set up to do that. But that leaves a lingering question about whether there is any real efficacy difference between the two regimens. And the answer at this point is we don't really know for sure. And on the other hand, there is the concern about cardiac toxicity with the anthracyclines, particularly in patients who are older, who have a borderline initial ejection fraction. At least from our institution standpoint, for those patients who are high risk, defined globally as node positive, we tend to default to the anthracycline-containing ACTH regimen, given the uncertainty about whether it may have some efficacy advantage, obviously not certain, and given the fact that most of the time the cardiac toxicity with trastuzumab seems to be reversible. And there is now some long-term follow-up data that seems to show that the rate of late events is quite low. For those patients who have low-risk disease, we do tend to give probably more anthracycline-based therapy than other institutions. But I think that that's the place where, you know, I think the reasonable question is whether to consider TCH or ACTH because of the toxicity issues. And then in the older patients, I think there the issue is, well, so if you have an older patient with node-negative disease, that's one thing. But what about the older patient who has node-positive disease? And we don't really know how best to weigh in an individual patient how to weigh those factors. We can do it on a population basis, but for the individual person sitting in front of you, we don't really have the tools to say, well, you have an X percent risk of cardiac toxicity, you have an X percent risk of efficacy difference, because even the efficacy part is not totally clear. And I think that adds to the uncertainty in the discussion.
So I think we should also mention leukemia and MDS.
Yes.
Actually, Lisa Carey presented a case to me yesterday of a patient who had gotten an anthracycline and got APL and is getting cured of it, which I never heard of.
My goodness. Wow.
But so, you know, for practical purposes, I mean, this editorial had a very prominent group of authors on it, and you came away thinking kind of like what you just said. You have a younger node positive patient without, you know, the cardiac risk factors. Think hard about an anthracycline. So let me ask you about a case situation. Tell me what you'd likely do. Real simple.
Okay.
60-year-old, otherwise healthy woman with one positive node, ER positive, HER2 positive.
So I would offer her anthracycline-based therapy. I would talk about TCH. I would check a baseline ejection fraction. You know, if she had a baseline ejection fraction in the low normal range, like 50%, I would tend a little more towards TCH. If she had a fairly normal ejection fraction to begin with, I would lean towards ACTH. But I would acknowledge to her that there is difference of opinion.
If I told you I presented this case to 100 oncologists in practice and 41 clinical breast cancer investigators, what fraction of the clinical investigators out of the 41, what fraction do you think would use an anthracycline?
20.
You got it exactly right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's because you read that editorial and you think, oh, all these prominent people are very anthracycline oriented, but there's a lot of other people out there who aren't.
Yep.
And it was more than half of the practicing oncologists.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your cases. And I actually want to start out with your third case because this patient went on a trial that I'm really curious about. I first heard about it, I think, about a year ago. But maybe you can just kind of talk about how she presented.
Sure. So this is a 60-year-old woman who presented on a screening mammogram with two lesions in her right breast, an 8 o'clock central lesion, a 9 o'clock lateral lesion. She had a biopsy which showed grade 3 invasive ductal, ERPR positive, HER2 negative on both biopsies. And then on imaging and exam was also found to have bulky axillary adenopathy measuring up to 4 centimeters. She had the usual staging studies which were negative, and then she received in the preoperative setting AC followed by paclitaxel, and then went on to undergo a mastectomy and axillary lymph node dissection. Although she had some amount of clinical response, At the time of her surgery, she was found to have a 2-centimeter area of residual disease in the breast at the 9 o'clock lesion. Interestingly, the 8 o'clock lesion actually had a pass CR. And then in the lymph nodes, she still had 5 residual positive lymph nodes out of 6. The largest deposit was 1.2 centimeters. It was a Miller-Payne 2 response. And she went on to receive radiation therapy and was started on anastrozole, given that this was an ER-positive cancer. So she came to me with the question of whether or not there would be any value to adding additional chemotherapy, given that she had a fairly significant amount of residual disease despite the standard anthracycline taxane regimen.
What was her sort of life situation? Was she working?
Yeah, so she's actually a very active, very vibrant 60-year-old woman who was working about 30 hours a week or so, performance status of 0, really no significant medical problems, some prior minor surgeries, but a very healthy person.
So did you gave her this initial treatment or somebody on the outside did?
Somebody on the outside did.
So she came kind of as a second opinion to you.
Correct.
Interesting.
That's right.
Was she out there on the internet looking for stuff or she just sort of kind of came in?
She came in. So we have a number of physicians who refer a high volume of patients to us for second opinion. So she came in through that mechanism.
Interesting. So maybe you can talk about what happened.
So as you know, for patients with residual disease, there is a somewhat higher rate of recurrence. This is most striking in patients with triple negative breast cancer, where there's a very clear separation, less so in patients with ER positive disease. Although my concern was that she, you know, I would be not surprised if she had grade 1 ER positive disease, because in those patients, we know that chemotherapy is not particularly efficacious from a pass CR standpoint, but she had grade 3 invasive ductal, and I would have hoped that she would have had a better response to chemotherapy. As you know, right now, there is no proven role for additional chemotherapy given out back in patients who have received a third-generation anthracycline taxane regimen in the pre-op setting and have residual disease. So I talked to her about a trial that we have ongoing, which is called the ABCDE trial, and this is a trial that's open at a couple of different sites across the country. And the randomization is actually a 2-by-2 randomization. The first randomization is either to a low-dose metronomic cyclophosphamide methotrexate regimen in combination with bevacizumab. And the second randomization is to a telephone-based exercise and lifestyle intervention versus not. And all patients receive a little bit of a cookbook and some dietary advice and different things like that. But the two randomizations are low-dose chemotherapy, yes-no, and the intensive lifestyle intervention, yes, no.
So what do we know about this metronomic chemo / bevacizumab regimen? I know you've looked at it in advanced disease.
Yeah, so Hal Burstein conducted a study, a phase 2 study in advanced disease. It was a randomized phase 2 of the CM regimen alone versus CM with bevacizumab. And the CM arm was closed early because of insufficient activity, but the CM bevacizumab arm did complete its full accrual, and there were responses seen in patients who had been heavily pretreated. So that then led to a pilot study in the post-pre-op setting where patients did receive this regimen just to demonstrate feasibility, and the patients could actually complete it with a reasonable side effect profile, and that has been completed by my colleague Erica Mayer. And so that's then led to the use of this regimen. You know, there was a lot of debate when the trial was designed as to what the systemic therapy randomization would look like. And there were thoughts about using capecitabine, and there were thoughts about using this particular regimen. There were thoughts about using bevacizumab as a single agent. And ultimately, you know, it was felt that there was activity of this regimen seen in the metastatic setting, and even in patients who had refractory disease. There's a rationale for the use of cyclophosphamide in the triple negative patients, where we had expected that a fair number of patients who enrolled in the study would have triple negative disease, and we had feasibility data in the post-pre-op setting.
So the part of it that really interested me was the diet lifestyle thing. And
yes.
I was just thinking, I think the WINS randomized study of dietary intervention was presented 2005. It was the same time as the trastuzumab studies. Look, all the stuff that's happened in Adjuvant HER2, and
right.
I'm not sure anything has happened in terms of diet and exercise.
Fortunately, I think this is an issue where it is a challenge to obtain the necessary funding to launch really definitive trials of lifestyle interventions, given that these are not things that a pharmaceutical partner is going to be that interested in. And The intervention that is being used in this study is a telephone-based intervention, so the advantage is that patients don't have to come into the study site to exercise or to do the activities. And in addition, it's scalable, so if it turns out that this is an intervention that has efficacy, then it's something that's scalable to a larger scale because it really involves a call center and calls that could go anywhere in the United States or elsewhere. The intervention in a previous study has been demonstrated to actually lead to weight loss. And of course, in our patients, one of the major complaints after completion of chemotherapy and on endocrine therapy is weight gain. And so at the very least, the intervention has been demonstrated to not only prevent weight gain after a breast cancer diagnosis, but to allow most women to lose weight, which is a huge plus.
Where are we right now in terms of clinical research on this issue, further clinical research, both biologically and clinically linking diet, metabolism? We've seen stuff on metformin. Mm-hmm. What do we know about it?
I think that this is a really interesting and growing area of research. There are different ways to interfere with this axis. One could think of pharmacologic methods like metformin and lifestyle-directed methods like diet and exercise interventions. And one of the really important things is that although it's very easy to tell people to make sure you're not gaining weight and try to exercise more, you know, it's hard to make lifestyle changes. And if it were demonstrated that a particular intervention led to better outcomes, you might imagine that this would then be covered by insurance and that people would have better access to it and you would really be able to provide people an intervention that works. So my colleague Jennifer Ligabel has been really involved in this area and she's been working very hard to try to launch a definitive randomized trial of lifestyle interventions in patients with stage 2 and 3 breast cancer.
Is there any sense in terms of what the potential magnitude might be on progression-free and overall survival?
So if one looks at the Nurses' Health study, for example, and looks at things like level of activity, and these are observational studies, so they all have the caveats, they're not randomized trials. But if you look at patients who exercise in the range of 150 minutes a week of moderate exercise, the relative difference in recurrence rates are very comparable to what you might see with adjuvant chemotherapy. So I think there is a huge potential. Again, the limitation of the observational studies is they're not randomized. You don't know what's different about patients who exercise versus who don't. But if this really were borne out in a prospective trial, it could really have a major impact.
And somehow I just flashed on the idea of doing an assay like the Oncotype and seeing whether or not there's any correlation with benefit of diet and exercise.
Yeah, I think that would be really cool.
So this lady, what was she randomized to?
So she was randomized to the arm to receive the low-dose cyclophosphamide methotrexate with the bevacizumab. She was not randomized to the exercise intervention, and so the default in that randomization is the dietary intervention.
I'm curious, do you think that just becoming aware of this study has affected, her lifestyle on her own?
I'm sure it has.
What have you seen with the patients who've been randomized to the intervention? Do they like it? Or is it a nuisance?
They do. So the patients who have been randomized to the intensive lifestyle intervention have actually uniformly felt very positive about it. And I think it's because you can immediately see the effects. So regardless of whether it improves disease-free survival, in other studies, for example, using the same intervention, there have been shown to be improvements in fatigue, in endurance, in weight. And these are all things that people can feel immediately.
So I want to ask you about your case 2, 45-year-old woman.
Yes.
You want to talk about her?
Oh, sure. So this is a 45-year-old premenopausal woman who in 2009 underwent a screening mammogram, was asymptomatic at that time, was found to have some architectural distortion in her right breast, and ultrasound showed a 2-centimeter mass at the 12 o'clock position. She actually had a very difficult exam. She had very fibrocystic breasts. She says that she was never able to really examine her breasts because there were just lumps everywhere. And indeed, on exam, both me and the surgeon, we felt masses of unclear significance at 10 o'clock, 2 o'clock, and 3 o'clock. So that prompted a breast MRI to further characterize her extent of disease. And she was found to have a 4-centimeter area of enhancement in the right breast surrounding the ultrasound-located nodule. And then there was an adjacent nodule at 2 o'clock measuring 1.5 centimeters. She had a biopsy of the ultrasound visible lesion, and this showed grade 1 ERPR positive, HER2 negative invasive ductal cancer. So I saw her, and at first the discussion was whether or not to consider neoadjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant endocrine therapy. And my feeling was that we didn't really understand at this point just how much disease she had, how much of it was DCIS versus invasive cancer. And so she proceeded initially to surgery, and she opted for a mastectomy. At the time of surgery, she had 3 lesions, 2.6 centimeters, 0.5 centimeter, and 0.6 centimeters. And they were each in, there were 2 lesions in the upper outer quadrant, 1 in the lower inner quadrant. They all looked similar, grade 1 ductal. There was no LVI. There was a sea of DCIS spanning these areas. She had 2 sentinel nodes, which were negative. And then all 3 areas of invasive cancer were retested for ERPR HER2, and it was confirmed again to be ER positive, PR positive, and HER2 negative.
What was her life situation and her attitude about chemo?
She is actually a fairly chemo-averse person, so her goal was to avoid chemotherapy.
So obviously the question comes up about oncotype in a patient like this.
Yeah. We talked about the oncotype. Given that this was a grade 1 ER-positive, HER2-negative cancer, one could make an argument that an oncotype was not absolutely necessary, and if she were absolutely going to refuse chemotherapy, I think one could have just simply given her endocrine therapy alone. She was chemotherapy-averse, but would take it if it looked like there would be a benefit, and so it seemed reasonable in her case to send off the oncotype.
I could imagine patients with this kind of situation who would feel like they only want chemo.
Yes, I can too. And I think here's where with a grade 1 strongly ERPR positive cancer, particularly if somebody were older, you know, imagine she were 60 and she really wanted chemotherapy, I would try to talk her out of it. And part of trying to talk her out of it would be actually to send off an oncotype.
So what did her oncotype show?
So it was a low risk score of 17. And she opted to proceed with tamoxifen and not with chemotherapy. We did discuss the TEXT study, the randomized study with ovarian suppression. She declined that study. It's now 2012. She's doing well so far.
So this brings up, of course, the issue of biology versus anatomy. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how you approach this question. Are you using Oncotype in node-positive disease, or are you using it in even larger node-negative tumors?
Yeah. The way that I tend to approach this is looking at tumor-related factors and then patient-related factors. So the tumor-related factors I'm looking at are the size, the lymph node status, the grade as the primary factors. From the patient standpoint, I'm looking at their age and performance status and comorbidities and their preferences. So in patients with negative lymph nodes, where I'm thinking about using the Oncotype is in those patients where either I or the patient is on the fence about chemotherapy. And that can differ based upon a number of characteristics. So, you know, for somebody with a 2.6 centimeter cancer like our patient, given that she was 45, I'd be more inclined to really want to know with a little bit more certainty whether she wouldn't or would or wouldn't benefit from chemotherapy. If she were 70 and she had a 2.6 centimeter grade 1 node negative cancer, I would be much more comfortable treating her with endocrine therapy without sending off an oncotype.
How about 4.8 centimeters?
I think 4.8, I would tend to send off an oncotype in that type of situation.
And what about node positive?
So node positive, again, is tricky. And I think the thing that I think about is what would be the cost of being wrong? That is that there is data for the Oncotype in node-positive patients based on the SWOG trial. The way that I approach it is if it turns out that Oncotype is not as predictive and node-positive as we might hope, what would the price of being wrong be? So what that means, practically speaking, is if somebody has 4, 5, 6 positive lymph nodes, I don't really offer the Oncotype because I don't really want to know. I think that even if the Oncotype score was low, one cannot rule out the possibility based upon the data that we have that there's a small relative risk reduction, and that translates into a measurable absolute risk reduction in patients with very high risk. I think that where I do tend to think about it is in those patients with limited nodal involvement and who wish to avoid chemotherapy.
Are you participating in the study looking at this RxPonder?
We are. It's going through our IRB.
I guess they allow up to 3 positive nodes.
Yeah.
How do you think that's going to be? And I don't know, did you put people on TailorX in the node negative trial?
We put a few people on TailorX at our institution. I put a few people on. It was interesting because I think the prediction for TailorX was that it was going to never accrue and it was going to die because of lack of accrual. But in fact, it was exceeded all expectations, accrued very quickly. With the RxPonder trial, in my communications with the overall PI, Ana Gonzalez, this trial was actually designed in a way to anticipate that a number of people would not accept the randomization. And so it was powered to have enough people enter into the actual randomization. And there were some predictions of what that rate would be. And so far, it actually, the predictions seem to be holding up. So it's not that people are getting the result and then just en masse not accepting the randomization. So it's actually going fairly well.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. And it's always, you know, we wonder though, when you, any trial, we don't do too many chemo versus no chemo trials anymore, but
yeah,
these are a couple of examples. Anything new in terms of alternative genomic tests? There is the MammaPrint that's out there. Is there anything out there, including MammaPrint, that you utilize?
So the genomic test that I utilize most routinely would be the Oncotype test. I have not routinely use the MammaPrint, and partly it's because I think the advantage of the Oncotype is that it helps you make specifically decisions about chemotherapy in the ER-positive patients where there is the most uncertainty about the benefit of chemotherapy on an individual patient basis. There's, of course, a lot of interest in the PAM50, although how really to use it clinically, I think, is not yet defined.
So have you actually ordered the MammaPrint?
I have not. I've seen people come in with MammaPrint ordered, and so I've talked with them about some of the issues, but I have not personally ordered it myself.